he wanted to be a sage, he wanted to be loved, and he wanted to be a radical. It's really hard to pull that one off. You know, I think in this country, we like our radicals, but we don't put them in charge.
This is East End Inc. Tonight, we present poet Mark Doty talking about his book, What is the Grass? Walt Whitman in My Life. The program is one of the online series produced by Kenio's Cultural Cafe. Mark Doty was introduced
by Kenio's Catherine Soka. Mark is an internationally renowned poet. We're thrilled that he's with us tonight, and it's wonderful to see him. Some of his previous poetry volumes include My Alexandria, Deep Lane, about the East End here where we are, Sweet Machine, and Fire to Fire. Mark was the winner of the National Book Award for Poetry in 2008. His previous memoirs include Heaven's Coast, Firebird, a memoir, and Dog Years, which was a New York Times bestseller. And his selection of essay collections include Still Life with Oysters and The Art of Description. Mark's many honors include the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Penn Martha Albrand Award for First Nonfiction, the LA Times Book Prize, and Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Writers Award, plus in the UK, the T.S. Eliot Prize. He's a professor at Rutgers, and of course, will be giving a master writing workshop in July. So tonight, we're really going to be focusing on his latest book, which is What is the Grass? Walt Whitman in My Life. The book is really a deeply personal memoir interwoven with an expansive and incisive close reading of the great poet Walt Whitman. We learn more and more about both poets' sensibilities as we progress through the book and the strong effect that Whitman had on Mark's life and on his work. We walk through Whitman's Brooklyn, we walk through Mark's Provincetown, we feel like we're there, and we see both poets kind of having a dialogue across the ages and more or less becoming more and more of themselves.
I read Whitman first in high school when I was discovering poetry, finding poetry for myself and falling in love with it. And I knew there were beautiful lines there, extraordinary images. But there was a barrier between myself and Whitman in that he was presented as a nationalist poet and as a patriot. I was a child of the late 60s. I was not interested in nationalism or patriotism. Those things were not available to me. And so I didn't quite know how to approach his work. And then in my very first teaching job, I was a sabbatical replacement for an American Lit professor who was on leave to Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. He had already prepared the reading list for his survey course in American literature, and the first text was a song of myself. So there I was teaching a 65-page poem to a group of young people who were taking a class because it met a humanities requirement. They were not especially interested in poetry. Social commentary. People are always discovering new aspects of his life. We're even finding new works of his. It's only in the last few years that a grooming manual for men that Whitman composed has been discovered in some small town newspaper. So what could I say about Whitman? What could I add to that? And I had the profound sense that I could, but I didn't know how. A sense that my own engagement with those poems was something to be cherished, to be attended to, and might open some doors for other readers as well. So I began to write about Whitman. And I've never worked so long and hard on a book in my life, many years of writing. I wrote first a long, unwieldy, lumpish book, which was kind of like climbing mountain walls. I had to get a sense of the shape of the whole. And then I looked at it and I thought, no one will want to read this. Where do I find the through line, the direction? It's been a long time. And I began to understand that what I was doing was going looking for him, that I wanted to keep company with a person I felt so profoundly behind these words, who tells us again and again that he is right behind the words. He wants to reach Susan and touch us. He says, you know, I'm weary of the cold tide and the ink between us. I want contact. He says, whoever touches this book touches a man. He says, stop with me this day and night, and you shall have the secret. You shall possess the secret of all poems. He says, I stop somewhere waiting for you. So there's a remarkable sense of always reaching to include us, hold us, and bring us face to face with him through the text. So the book finally became a way of talking back to him and of trying to see how these poems came into being. When Whitman was a younger man, he was a bookseller, a carpenter, an itinerant school teacher. He had a third grade education in the Brooklyn Public Schools, which meant simply that he recited back statements that the teachers made, or they were in their text, and the whole class would recite these poorly. He did that for 3 years, dropped out of school, was apprenticed to a printer and journalist, which was a common combination of the time, and learned to trade. He produced, before he was 35, a kind of corny temperance novel, a detective story, some rather sentimental poems, and various newspaper articles. There is nothing to make you think that this man was going to write some of the greatest American poems, not only of his century, but ever, some of the poems that people are reading around the world right now in every language into which poetry is translated, that he would reinvent American poetry in terms of style and form, that he would write the first direct same-sex love poems in English since the Renaissance, and what else? That he would be a poet that we just simply cannot stop reading. So how did that happen? What were the sources of that work? And one of the things I've tried to do in the book is to talk about where these poems came from. How could they have been named? And I want to read you just a handful of pages here. Dinner seemed to pour from the artist's hand, so long school those hands had become, but years of labor informed those spontaneous productions. Though a poem over which one struggles may seem labored, it often prepares the way for new writing in which what's been learned emerges with an effortless grace. In the end, though, work accounts for a poem of genius about as much as plumbing accounts for the fountains of Rome. It yields the necessary basis, the practical scaffolding that underlies the whole, but it cannot in itself engender a sense of transport. To shift the figure from water to another element, labor may give a poem a ruddy glow, but no amount of it will set the page on fire. The great poems of Leaves of Grass are spectacularly, uniquely on fire. There are, I admit, only a handful of them, although one is long enough that you can wander in it like a labyrinth, uncertain of where you're headed, but gradually, undeniably arriving someplace entirely new. The brilliant mid-century American poet and critic Randall Jarrell wrote that a good poet is someone who manages in a lifetime of standing out in thunderstorms to be struck by lightning 5 or 6 times, a dozen or 2 dozen times, and he is great. Who besides Shakespeare might have been struck 2 dozen times, I cannot say. Even in the life work of many of our greatest poets, a few dazzling electrical flashes are brighter than all the rest. We think no less of John Keats because he didn't write more of those odes, or of Elizabeth Bishop because Geography 3 isn't longer. What daring heat and light Whitman's masterwork emits. They proceed with absolute confidence to make the wildest claims, inventing a cosmogony, theology, a stance toward reality. They burn with evangelical urgency, yet insist that no one requires a spiritual teacher. They find the basis for a social compact in the common bedrock of the desiring human body, and sing the inclusive, generous, common self in a mode so formally invented that its first readers must have wondered if these were poems at all. The combination of unbridled content and unfamiliar form seems to have left even writers of considerable acumen in the dust. Emily Dickinson is said to have taken a peek inside the book and firmly closed it. I don't believe that personally, but that's the rumor. Henry James noted with devastating simplicity, this will not do. I would like to think that writers of such genius, whatever they may have said, recognized as kin the astonishing outpouring of work that appeared from the hand of a self-proclaimed rough in Brooklyn, but there is no evidence that they did. There is surely an uncomfortable sort of admiration and kinship expressed in a letter from the great tormented Jesuit poet Gerard Manley Hopkins, though. I always knew in my heart Walt Whitman's mind to be more like my own than any other man's living. As he is a very great scoundrel, this is no pleasant confession. The method of this book, because I didn't want to write a biography, there's a very great one by Paul Zweig. I do not want to write a book of traditional literary criticism because there are plenty of those. I wanted to make something more personal that looked at intersections between my obsessions and Whitman's, looked at the ways that my life has been changed by his work, that I feel he resides as a spirit, as a presence. And so these sections about him are interleaved, as it were, with bits of memoir. And so I'm just going to read you a little bit from that same chapter about an early experience as a sort of developing, searching writer. And some of you will recognize the poet William Eberson, who appears in here. He was also known as Brother Antoninus, one of the beat poets who was especially theatrical and dramatic. When I was 25, I went to a writer's conference, my first on the California coast, on an idyllic Santa Cruz campus of yellow grassland pouring down the slopes to the sea. There were workshops and readings and a good deal of staying up till one could drink no more, convivial nights of long talks, most often about our wish to become ourselves as writers, whatever that might mean, about longing, our deep desire to feel complete, real to ourselves. I made a raft of friends, a lean and intense fiction writer trying to find her way inside a novel that eluded her, the West Coast editor of Playgirl, a joyful Zoftig beauty who wore metallic caftans and shared with me her delicious, slender little cigars. It was 1978. I was still married and secretive about my longing for men, but I had a mad crush on a warm, bearish man whose every gesture seemed to spread sweetness and good humor. Like a Playgirl editor, he occupied space with notable delight in being a body. Toward the end of the gathering, he told me, in an embrace flushed with wine and heat, that if he hadn't been having an affair with the woman across the hall from my room, he'd have been with me. That would have been possible? I was dazed, so happy with the idea that such a thing could have happened, I honestly didn't mind so much that it hadn't. There was another set of events, too, richer and stranger. The poet William Eberson, the elder animating spirit of the place, who had once been Brother Antoninus, a Dominican monk who renounced the order to pursue both art and pleasure, offered a series of meditative lectures, a loosely structured performance over several mornings called The Birth of the Poets. And he believed that this great encyclopedic poem was he co-authored it. You know, it poured through him. It emerged. Those early poems have a great force that the later ones lack. I do not say that Whitman just declined. He was always an uneven poet. He would write a magnificent poem, like Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, and 2 days later he would write a poem like Song of the Broadaxe, which is a hymn to cutting down the forest instead of doing Native Americans. You know, and it's a cliched poem would come right after something of extraordinary originality. It's hard to understand that, except that he was driven early on by a creative fire. He needed to work, and he understood that he was making something uniquely American, that he didn't think of it in the way that most poets conceive their work. I think we tend to we're making poems that are expressions of personal feeling. We hope people will find them, make use of them. Who believes that the poems you write will change the world? He did. He said later that he wished he had been an orator instead of a poet, because he would have influenced more people that way by giving speeches. Interesting, you know, point of view, that his purpose was to change how we live and how we think about ourselves. He mounted a full tilt assault on the idea that we are discrete individuals held apart from each other in our separate sacks of skin. And he believed that at its core, the self is sort of something we hold in common. There is a mutuality about it. He believed that we could found a social order, a true democracy, based upon our affection for each other. Erotic, familial, the affection, friendship, all that together could remake the world in which we find ourselves. That's a tall order for poems to do. And if you look at, after he did that first edition, his second edition, which he published a year later, without probably selling any of the first edition at all, he just had more poems to put in it, is changed in its shape. Now, the book is about this big, it's very thick, and it's designed to fit in the pocket of your work jacket. So you can take it with you everywhere. You can read it outdoors. He actually advises that it would be a good idea to read Leaves of Grass naked outside once a year. You know, it's great. And it will guide you and lead you forward. It's a beautiful ambition. It's obviously a doomed one, particularly when you think about what came just a few years later. If he published his first edition in 1855, it's not very far until 1860, when the real clouds of the Civil War darken, when people, the young men of Brooklyn are marching off to fight in the South. And instead of seeing the young embrace one another out of common affection, he sees them tearing each other apart.
This is East End, Inc. We're listening to poet Mark Doty talking about his book, What is the Grass? Walt Whitman in My Life.
And it must have been enormously painful to him to not feel that that vision could become real. He understood later on that his America, he said this to Horace, was something that never existed. He knew it didn't exist. It was an ideal. It was a possibility. And for him, it was always something he was inscribing on the edge of time so that we might get there. He was not naive. He was very hopeful. He was naive about one thing, which is that he believed that he could be both a sexual radical, writing just the most homoerotic poems in forever, also writing poems that were decidedly feminist, that granted women sexual desire, independence, will, intelligence, and also write poems that were distinctly anti-racist in his first editions, and think that he could be a spiritual leader too, or a national leader. So he wanted to be a sage, he wanted to be loved, and he wanted to be a radical. It's really hard to pull that one off. You know, I think in this country, we like our radicals, but we don't put them in charge, you know? And the people in charge, we want a certain kind of conservatism out of them. You know, so there's a battle going on in him. He would bend over backwards to be liked. He would write poems like, Oh Captain, My Captain, you know, which is the most popular poem wrote in his lifetime. It's a very Victorian, rhymed and metered ode to President Lincoln. It's just awful, right? And at the same time, he would write When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloom, which is a masterpiece of an elegy to the same person. These conflicting impulses were with him all his life, and they are one of the things that very much made him himself. He was a New Yorker, and therefore he was a self-promoter, and he was not shy, and he liked to shine, you know, and he liked to hold the crowd's attention. And he was very much a man of his times. This is the era that gave us marketing. There's a famous story about Whitman being photographed with a butterfly on his finger. And he said to Horace, said, you know, animals really like me. And it was coming, and we were talking, and it was visiting me often. The butterfly was made of cardboard. And I think it's the New York Public Library now, collection, the bird collection. You know, it's made for some commercial products, got printing on it. But he was not above passing this off as real. So I call it character, a real visionary who was also, a salesman. It's a terrible poem because it's primarily, it's so stiff. It is straitjacketed by rhyme and meter. Whitman takes that same kind of idea, the wish to merge, and puts it in a colloquial syntax. He uses a version of American speech, which is dramatic and repetitive. It has cadences that come mostly out of the King James Bible, in his poems anyway. And of course, American speech was inflected by scripture too. It was very much, part of what shaped us, as did Shakespeare. So all that. Now, of course, we have other ways of entertaining ourselves. But remember, in the 19th century, people read at home at night because that's what you could do. And every household pretty much had a Bible, a complete Shakespeare, and Paradise Lost. So we could count on people being informed by those influences, which were pretty splendid rhetorical influences.
Okay, so we have a question from Caitlin at the Whitman Center, Walt Whitman Place. She says that Whitman seems to have an epiphany of sorts before he wrote Leaves of Grass. What do you think led him to think and write so differently at that point in his life?
I think this is one of the sources of his great work, that something happened to him, that something was probably informed by what he was reading. We know he read the Bhagavad Gita and was very interested in different kinds of thinking, philosophical bases or theological bases of thinking about the self and about personality. But I think he had an experience. And the experience of that is the closest thing we have to a record of it is very early on in Song of Myself, when he describes an erotic encounter on the grass on a transparent summer morning. And the way he sets it up, he's kind of suggesting that this encounter is with his own soul. But, he uses one of the slippery stanza breaks of his, so you don't really know if the person that he's talking about in that first stanza is the same one he's talking about in the second stanza or not. But he says that you, whoever you are, placed his or her face on his lap, put one hand to his beard and one hand to his feet, and then they proceeded to make love. And he says, swiftly arose around me the peace and understanding that passes all knowledge of earth, or is it all peace and knowledge that passes all understanding of earth? And he goes on this beautiful stanza in which he describes being elevated by this experience of communion. This is a classic description of a kind of peak experience, because what happens in those seems to be that the boundary between self and other dissolves. So there he is having this ecstatic lovemaking, and suddenly he understands that he doesn't stop at his own skin, and he feels connected to everything. So he says, I know that the hand of God is the elder hand of my own. Elder hand, what an extraordinary word. I know that the men and women are, my brothers and lovers. He says, and a kelson of the creation is love. The kelson is the big wooden beam that holds a wooden ship together. So if the kelson of the creation is love, that means the creation is continuous, constructed. It means it's going somewhere, a boat is heading forward, and that it's held together by our love for each other, by the world's love for us and our love for it. He goes on then, amazingly, to extend that warmth of that vision down to the little stones and the mossy scabs and the sticks on the ground. If he ended on this great rhetorical note, I wouldn't believe as much. But because his sense of great compassion and connection spills over to the smallest objects, it feels utterly convincing to me. So I think he had the kind of experience that might be described as en route to enlightenment, as a peak experience, a mystical experience, whatever you want to call it. I don't think those are rare. It seems to me that many people, and certainly many artists, have experiences that are given to us, that are ones in which we feel the boundary dissolve, and we feel our sense of connectedness, the real largeness of ourselves.
Great.
Very much, because we don't have much of a vocabulary for them, right? And because it's hard to carry that experience on in your daily life. It's hard to, when you go to the bank, you may not remember that you and the banker are of the same fabric or not. It's a different kind of operation we do in our daily lives. But I think he was transformed by that. I think he was also transformed by the language of America in that moment, by his incredible sexual experience, which gave him an outsider's perspective onto the culture. He was always seeing things slightly askew, by his deep fascination with death, and by his love of New York City. You know, before Whitman, poets are trashing cities right and left. Wordsworth couldn't stand the city. Blake, you know, I mark in every face I meet marks of weakness, marks of woe. Whitman is the first poet to just say, woof, New York, yeah. He's saying, you know, what rewards me in New York? Continual lovers always reward me. He loves cruising. He loves looking at people. He loves riding stagecoaches up and down Broadway and seeing what's in the shop windows. And that's a precedent that he creates for Hart Crane and then for Frank O'Hara, who after him are poets of great embrace and delight in the city and its randomness, you know, its opportunities, its surprises, flashes. Tell you, this is not going to be a direct story about Whitman, but it's an analogous story. I have a poem, it's in Deep Lane, it's called The King of Fire Island. It's a poem about a wounded deer that I had a relationship with that was difficult, the painful one. I love this deer and did not survive. And I wrote this poem as a kind of straight out narrative, and I carried that narrative around for almost 2 years. It didn't have an ending. I just didn't know what to do with it. The story was not the poem. And I was sitting in my favorite cafe in the city, place I like to go and write, back in the day, and we could do that. And I looked at that poem, the computer file, and I suddenly thought, what would Stanley do with this? I mean, Stanley Kunitz, I was thinking of, who has been that kind of figure for me, a person of enormous courage, and he was sort of, he would follow an impulse anywhere he had to, you know, to get the poem, to catch the poem whole. He was willing to go where he didn't know. He was willing to go places that frightened him. He understood that as being the artist's imperative, really. And I finished the poem. And I was sitting there, I mean, it was so crazy because I was sitting with the tears streaming down my face. I mean, finished this poem in this coffee shop, and I look up, and there's Marie House, you know, right, who was also there having coffee. And it was like, she understood what had happened. It was an amazing moment. But I think what our models of great poets do for us is to instill courage, you know? And Whitman's marvelous for that. You think, he is willing to take these strides and to make a claim on reality. Who else is, you know, who is American poet is willing to talk about ontology in that way? What does it mean to be you? You know, what do you make of that? That's just remarkable that he could do that with claim this authority. And that's something that we get from Dickinson. It's something we get from Rilke, you know, from great poets who are willing to wrestle experience to the ground in the search of some kind of understanding.
This is East End Inc., and we heard Mark Doty talking about What is the Grass? Walt Whitman in My Life. The book was published by W.W. Norton in April of 2020. Other works by Mark Doty include Art of Description from Grey Wolf Press in 2010 and Fire to Fire from HarperCollins in 2009. Upcoming free literary events produced by the nonprofit Canio's Cultural Cafe are online and are listed at caneos.com. Click on Calendar of Events. East End Inc. is heard on the 4th and occasionally the 5th Wednesday of each month. Programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Podcasts are available at soundcloud.com. Search for East End Inc. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Calendrill and Catherine Soka. I'm Francesca Rianni.